The Olympics are watched by millions of sports fans. But before the games arrive in any host city, there's an enormous transformation that happens. From the Global Reporting Center and PRX, State of Play is a new podcast investigating how the Olympic Games change big cities. This season, we'll take you to Paris, Vancouver, and LA to meet the people who are pushed out and priced out in the name of sports. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Weeks after pushing into Kursk, Ukraine has launched one of its largest drone attacks on Moscow.
Some of these attacks have been political, and they've been aimed to show Russia that Russians are not invulnerable, and they've been intended to damage Russian prestige and the prestige of Russian leaders.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today on the show, the risks and payoffs of Ukraine taking the war inside Russia.
Also, Houthi militias continue to fire on ships in the Red Sea. And we turn our sights to a much smaller battle between Turkey and Germany.
I love it. It's just like home all in one little pita pocket. That's amazing.
Over doner kebab.
Plus, overseas students are back at work on the Jersey Shore.
An offer popped from Playland, and I said, oh, it's an amusement park. It would be pretty cool to work on one.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. It's good to have you with us on this Wednesday. For many Russians, the war in Ukraine has seemed far away and not top of mind. The Ukrainian military may be changing that perception.
In recent weeks, Ukraine has been pressing ahead with a major incursion into Russia's Kursk region. And last night, the Ukrainian army targeted Moscow itself in what the mayor called one of the largest ever drone attacks on the capital. Russia's Ministry of Defense said overnight that its forces shot down 45 Ukrainian drones in total, including 11 targeting the capital city.
Michael Kaufman is at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he's an expert on the Russian military. He says Ukraine has been steadily increasing the scale of its attacks on Russia and its military.
They've struck different types of targets, in some cases going after airfields, military targets, in others going after the Russian energy sector, oil refineries, fuel tanks, and the like. But some of these attacks have been political, and they've been aimed to show Russia that, in fact, Russians are not invulnerable, and they've been intended to damage Russian prestige and the prestige of Russian leaders.
So clearly, Kyiv is bringing the war to Russia more effectively. We've seen the offensive in the Kursk region, now these drones over Moscow. What is Ukraine actually hoping to accomplish?
The Kursk offensive right now is still a developing operation. It looks like Ukraine intends to anchor in and create a buffer inside Russian territory with the goal of holding it either to use later on as a bargaining chip in the event there are negotiations, or at the very least, in an effort to bait Russia into diverting a significant amount of Russian forces from the rest of the front line, hoping that they will then attack the salient. That could then lead to a grinding battle, but one that saps a lot of Russian strength and initiative. Down the line, that could relieve the pressure that Ukraine is currently experiencing along a fairly broad front.
And you see last night's drone deployments over Moscow as having a different kind of impact?
The purpose of those attacks usually is, if they're not going after military targets or economic targets, they're primarily aimed at Russian prestige and to remind Russians of the degree of vulnerability that they have to Ukrainian strike capabilities. And often they're also retaliatory for Russian strikes that are conducted on a regular basis across Ukraine.
So looking at the Russian forces now going into Kursk, what are the potential impacts on the war elsewhere, especially on the eastern front lines in Donetsk?
So far, Russia's trying to cobble together a force to respond to the Kursk incursion by drawing on conscripts from deep within Russia and moving units from more stable fronts such as Kharkiv or Zaporizhia without diverting a substantial amount of forces from the current offensives that they have in progress. Now, that may change, and Russian military has not yet attempted very significant counterattacks against the Kursk salient. It has, though, drawn quite a bit of Russian aviation in an effort to support their forces there. So far, we're only in the third week of the operation, so it's not clear yet how Russia will respond. And they've not yet been able to stabilize that front line. That is, Ukraine has continued to expand the territory that it controls.
Is there anything that you can tell from Ukraine's push into Kursk and Russia's response to it about the capabilities of both militaries at this point?
It's clear that the Ukrainian military has taken lessons from the failed 2023 summer offensive. The way they conducted this operation appeared to be much better planned, held in tight secrecy, and had good employment of different combinations of military capabilities, supporting units, what have you. Right? The Russian military, I think, continues to struggle in responding to any sort of dynamic situation when there's a crisis and is often a disadvantage, as is the Russian leadership writ large. If you look at the somewhat shambolic response to the initial incursion into Kursk, that is the first days of the operation. That said, it's not easy to extrapolate from this offensive, which met fairly light resistance from Russian border guards and some conscript units, to what could be done across the broader sort of front line that is held by large numbers of forces with entrenched defenses and what have you. So here we have to be careful. And there's still a lot we don't know about the operation in terms of what really happened in the first days and why.
Given some of the embarrassment that Ukraine has exacted on Russia in recent days, including the last night's drones over Russia's capital city, are you anticipating a more robust Russian retaliation or counteroffensive at some point soon? Like, how risky is Ukraine's offensive?
The offensive has a clear upshot, but it also comes with significant risks. First, Ukrainian forces could get stuck holding that pocket while their already fairly stretched military is struggling across the front, and some of the Ukrainian defensive lines in other regions like Donetsk have been buckling. Second, if Russia doesn't take the bait and there isn't a significant counterattack or diversion of Russian forces, if they simply try to contain it while still pushing offensives in other areas, then, you know, Ukraine may end up holding this pocket, but without substantial gains, and could also lose some territory of its own. And that's still a bit unclear. Like I said, it's still barely a third week into the offensive.
That's Michael Kaufman, an expert on the Russian military at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Elsewhere on the continent, Turkey and Germany are at loggerheads, but not violently. It's a battle over a beloved street food. We're talking about döner, a sandwich of spiced meat sliced off a large rotating slab. This summer, an organization representing Turkish döner makers asked the European Union to certify their version as a guaranteed traditional specialty. But döner makers in Germany, many of them with Turkish heritage, are challenging that request. The World's Jory Buscarin in Istanbul dives into the controversy.
Muhatin Koparan takes his döner very seriously. He keeps a wood fire stoked to roast the meat as it turns on the vertical spit at his shop in Istanbul. It's always 30% lamb, he says. The rest is beef. You never tell the spices. It's a secret, Koparan says. The EU designation for döner that Turkey is seeking is granted to traditional regional specialties like Serrano ham in Spain and feta cheese in Greece. If Turkey is successful, the dish can only be sold as döner if it fits standardized criteria, like being sliced to a certain thickness and having no non-animal additives. As far as Koparan is concerned, döner is a Turkish specialty, not German, Turkish.
Yani Türkler de biliyorsunuzdur, eti çok seviyor. Yani döner bizim kültürümüz. Çok seviyoruz.
You know Turks love meat, he says. Döner is our culture. Döner comes from the Turkish verb to turn. The earliest recipes date back to 19th century Ottoman cookbooks. But the dish migrated to West Germany when hundreds of thousands of Turkish workers moved there in the 1960s and 70s. Turkish döner is now one of the most popular street foods in Germany. But it's made a little differently.
Döner ismini almalarında karşı değiliz ama...
Gürsel Ulber runs the Association of Turkish Döner Manufacturers in Europe, based in Berlin. He says Germany isn't against Turkey seeking special status for döner, but he says the proposed standards don't fit our style and they didn't ask us. For instance, certain traditional ingredients, like tail fat, are hard to find in Germany. Having to include it would drive up the price. What's more, German döner shops are famous for their experimentation, adding sauerkraut, mango sauce, even vegan döner to their menus. The new generation is trying to create alternatives, Ulber says. And so we have a crisis. a doner duel, if you will. Naturally, I decided it was time to engage in a little bit of sandwich diplomacy.
All right, Josh. What are we eating?
Josh Koh is my colleague in Munich, Germany.
God, I am dying for this right now.
We agreed that I would go to my neighborhood doner shop in Istanbul, while he would go to his favorite one in Germany, and we'd compare.
Yours looks actually kind of more like a hoagie or something. Am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy. I could see that as a hoagie.
Our doners are certainly different when we hold them up to the screen. Mine is simple. Seasoned meat, sliced tomatoes, and french fries ensconced in bread. Josh's doner, which he pronounces duner, is bursting with ingredients.
Right here I have chicken. I did a very typical chicken duner. But the chicken duner also includes some cucumbers and like three different kinds of sauces, some crunchy cabbage, and maybe like, I don't know how to describe it, but basically they just say hot. Do you want it hot? And I add hot. So it's this really spicy kind of chipotle.
These spicy pepper flakes are called urfa biber. I have some on the table here in the Istanbul doner shop, nestled in a little bowl with a spoon.
Terry, I don't know if they do this, but they put fresh pomegranate seeds inside as well. Is that a thing in Turkey?
That's never something that you'd put on a Turkish doner, but we do use pomegranate seeds in everything else.
Slowly, I start to realize that the components of Josh's sandwich are all nods to dishes that people in Turkey enjoy separately. The marinated cucumbers and tomatoes, which we call çoban salatası. The yogurt and herb sauce, which sounds a lot like a popular soup called cacık.
Really?
Yeah, and so it sounds like whoever invented the German form of doner just kind of took a lot of side dishes and put it together on a sandwich.
I love it. It's just like home all in one little pita pocket. That's amazing.
We agree on this point. Both doner are delicious. Next, we turn to the real experts, the chefs who made our sandwiches. We each hand them our phones so they can discuss.
The
Turkish system is difficult to navigate here in Germany, says Naif Taskaran, who was born in southern Turkey but moved to Germany some years ago. The two of them get into a real doner debate over the thickness of the slices and whether doner should be served with special salads and sauces. Muhattin Koparan, who made my doner, is not a fan. He thinks they distract from the taste of the meat. Plus, he says, when you do something extra here in Turkey, no one ever eats it. Turkish and German doner makers have a few months to come to a compromise on how to standardize doner. If they can't come to an agreement, the European Commission will make its own ruling. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
So this happened today. A German warship made its way down the Thames in London, part of a regular supply stop. The captain decided to blast out the Darth Vader theme while chugging through the British capital.
It is quite the choice. A ship from Germany, dreaded enemy of Britain through two world wars, playing the Imperial March in a city that survived the Blitz.
Carolyn, by the way, have you ever watched Star Wars in German?
I have not.
Ich bin dein Vater. Nein, das ist nicht wahr.
I really didn't think that scene could get any more dramatic.
Meanwhile, back on the Thames, a spokesperson for the German Navy told the BBC not to read too much into it. The captain is free to choose the music. He just happens to be a huge Star Wars and John Williams fan.
But he doesn't limit himself to just one genre. For example, this is from a ship spotter's account on YouTube.
As FGS Braunschweig approaches Tower Bridge, it starts to play London Calling by The Clash.
Very appropriate.
In the Navy would have also been pretty on the nose.
Yeah, true. Just stay away from Wagner. I do get the sense, though, Carolyn, that Der Kapitän joined the German Navy and went through the grueling training regimen just for the music.
There's no way, Marco. He could have just been a DJ and not had to do so many push-ups, at least I assume.
Yeah, probably. Anyway, who said the Germans have no sense of humor?
You're listening to The World.
The This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. An oil tanker was attacked today in the Red Sea off the coast of Yemen. Men in small boats fired on the ship while more attacks came from the air. The tanker was last seen drifting and on fire, but no casualties have been reported. While no one has claimed responsibility, this is the latest episode in more than 80 similar attacks by the militant group known as the Houthis. The U.S. and Europe condemn the Houthis' actions, which have disrupted global shipping. But inside Yemen, the Houthis' maritime campaign has popular support. Abdul Ghani Al-Iryani is watching all of this. He's at the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies in Yemen.
The Houthis have made it very clear from the start that they're going to lay siege on trade going to Israel as long as Gaza is under siege. They have, of course, not been very precise at targeting Israeli ships, and some of their strikes were indiscriminate, but the objective, as declared, is that they are laying siege to Israel.
Now, shipping companies have been rerouting vessels to avoid the Red Sea, and that's led to international condemnation, as you know, of the Houthis. How are shipping attacks seen by people inside Yemen?
The Yemenis are very passionate about the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian suffering, and they're tired of seeing dead babies in Gaza. So although they know that the acts of the Houthis in the Red Sea will cause further hardship, they are willing to pay the price. For them, it is worth it to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
I mean, the Houthis don't control all of Yemen. So are you saying everyone supports this despite the hardships?
Yes. In fact, the population at large is in support of the Palestinians. And I have personally heard commanders who are in the forces that are fighting the Houthis declare that they are pro-Houthi in support of the Houthis' action in the Red Sea.
I mean, it's a bit of a head-scratcher because under Houthi control, people are going hungry. Civil liberties have been breached, and a lot of people have been arrested and disappeared. So why are they popular?
They were not. That's the irony of it all. The Houthis are generally hated.
But it's fair to say they're popular today, it sounds like, yeah?
Yeah, they are able to mobilize hundreds of thousands of people to the city squares. But I don't think this popularity will last much longer, because the Houthis are really hated by the general population. They are so corrupt and so ruthless.
So that's interesting. They're hated, but right now they're admired for their willingness to attack interests that are connected to Israel and the U.S.?
That's correct, yes. Some people in Yemen know that the price that Yemenis, the general public in Yemen, will pay for this act of solidarity is disproportionate to the benefit that may come out of it to the Palestinians. But Yemenis, as I said, are exceptionally passionate about the Palestinian people.
The Houthis are being seen as a full partner in the Iranian-sponsored axis of resistance. That includes Hezbollah and Hamas. But that's new. The Houthis used to claim to be independent of Iran. What changed?
That is correct. Actually, the Houthis have been somewhat independent of Iran. And the difference between them and Hezbollah is that they do not have the same religious values. The Houthis are not the brand of Shia that is common in Iran, and therefore they do not owe religious loyalty to the leader of Iran, Khamenei, and they are more likely to break away from Iran if their interests become different from those of Iran. But when they started their action in the Red Sea, and they, of course, then invited the retaliation of the U.S. and America and Britain and the EU possibly at some point, they knew that they need the protection of being a full integrated member of the axis of resistance led by Iran, so that if they are targeted in a big way by the West, they will have the support of other members of the axis of resistance.
Abdul Ghani Al-Iryani is an analyst at the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies in Yemen.
For a long time, businesses on the Jersey Shore have depended on overseas students to work the summer tourist season. Then came the COVID-19 pandemic, when the U.S. government suspended visa approvals. But this summer, the seasonal workers have finally returned at pre-pandemic levels. Kenneth Burns with WHYY News reports.
Yordan Yordanov is a business management student from Bulgaria. He's spending the summer here in New Jersey for the second year in a row. He says he has always wanted to see what life is like in America.
They just said, hey, you can check this state, New Jersey. It's pretty safe. You can choose from a different offers there. And an offer popped from Playland. And I said, oh, it's an amusement park. It would be pretty cool to work on one.
This year, Yordanov is one of 25 overseas students working at Playland's Castaway Cove in Ocean City. He is here on a J-1 visa, which allows overseas residents into the U.S. on a work-study visitor exchange. Lisa Murray, director of the American Immigration Council's exchange program, says the very grand scheme behind the initiative was diplomacy, with the thought of letting people into the U.S. to study and build experiences with host organizations.
By doing these exchanges, you're placing people in the U.S., they're taking that experience, they're returning home, and they're sharing that experience. And so that's where kind of the diplomacy helps out.
According to the State Department, New Jersey was in the top 10 for summer work travel destinations last year. Ryan Hartley, vice president of Playland's Castaway Cove, says overseas students fill an important gap in the summer tourist season, especially in the last weeks of August.
When all of our college kids go back to college, when the high school kids start their sports and they have their practices, and people go on vacation in the last week because they're starting school right after Labor Day, so parents want to take the kids away for one last trip.
Hartley says it's not all work for the students he hires.
We'll have a miniature golf tournament that we're going to do with all the kids. We have a couple employee parties after the park closes. We encourage them to take off some time in July when we have plenty of staffing, so this way they can go and travel. You know, they like to go to travel. They go down to Miami, D.C., New York. They're here not only to work, but for the cultural experience as well.
The federal government, under the Trump administration, suspended J-1 visas in the second half of 2020 due to the COVID pandemic. Those restrictions were eased under the first year of the Biden administration. Murray says she is seeing numbers return to near pre-COVID levels.
It's taken us a few years to kind of get back up to our pre-COVID numbers. I would say that we are definitely there now.
A State Department spokesperson says that substantial improvements were made last year in reducing wait times across all visa categories. For the last couple of years, more than 4,900 overseas students came to the Garden State for a summer work travel program. Yordan Yordanov hopes to take what he's learned in New Jersey and apply it to when he starts his own clothing business back in his home country.
I'm asking a lot of questions to the owner, to the Brian, about how they advertise the amusement park, because, again, I don't think it's on TV.
He says he plans to travel a lot more within the U.S. this year, with Miami at the top of his list of places he wants to explore. Yordanov says New Jersey could be his second home, unless he falls in love with South Florida. For the World, I'm Kenneth Burns, Ocean City, New Jersey.
In Canada, summer wildfires have forced thousands of people from their homes in a country that does not have a federal disaster relief agency. Leaders there are looking abroad for ideas to create one.
We have to take a look at what will our FEMA at the national level will look like. But we're also talking to Australia, and we've started even discussions with the French as well.
That's still ahead this half hour on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been shuttling around the Middle East this week, trying to make a ceasefire deal happen between Hamas and Israel. Blinken says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has agreed to what's being called a bridging proposal. It's a U.S. plan to close the gaps between what Hamas and Israel are willing to do. But there are still some sticking points, including whether Israeli troops would remain in two strategic areas inside the Gaza Strip. The World's Shirin Jafari is here with more. Shirin, what are these two areas?
One of them is called the Philadelphia Corridor, and the other is the Netzarim Corridor. Let me start with the Philadelphia Corridor. That's a narrow strip of land about 7 miles long between Egypt and Gaza. Israel controlled this area until 2005, but after it withdrew from Gaza, it no longer had any troops there. That changed in May after Israel entered Rafah in southern Gaza and retook control of the Philadelphia Corridor. It now controls that area, and it says it wants to keep its forces there.
Why is that? What is the argument that Israel is making to keep its troops there?
Well, yesterday in an interview with the Jerusalem Post, the Minister of Diaspora Affairs, Amichai Shikli, described this corridor as Hamas's lifeline. He said that the Israeli military has found dozens of tunnels, some of them large enough for vehicles to pass through and dozens more smaller ones. Shikli said that if Israel leaves the Philadelphia corridor, even for a short time, that means that Hamas can use the tunnels to transfer weapons into the Gaza Strip.
So this corridor is right on the border with Egypt. How does Egypt view Israeli troops being there on its border?
Publicly, Egypt is against this. Here's what the former assistant foreign minister, Hossein Haridi, said about this to Al Jazeera yesterday.
Egypt has always rejected the permanent Israeli presence, military presence in the Philadelphia corridor, as well as an Israeli control over the Palestinian side of the Rafah crossing. And this remains the Egyptian position.
As for Hamas, it strongly opposes any Israeli presence in the Gaza Strip. It accuses Benjamin Netanyahu of adding new demands to the ceasefire proposal in order to delay and derail the talks. Today, Bassem Naim, the head of the political wing of Hamas, told me in a message that the group wants a total withdrawal of Israeli troops from the Gaza Strip. He said that in the first phase of the deal, the troops would withdraw to the borders of Gaza, and then in the second phase, they should completely leave the Gaza Strip.
So let's talk now about that second corridor that is in question, Netzarim. What is the significance of this one?
Netzarim divides northern Gaza from the south, and it runs from the Israeli border to the coast. It's south of Gaza City, and it's about 4 miles long. And Netanyahu says Israeli troops should stay there to prevent Hamas militants from returning to the north, which has been largely cleared since October. Again, Hamas rejects that and says once you have any Israeli troops inside Gaza, no matter where they are, that would amount to a military occupation.
So where is all of this heading, these conversations about these corridors? Could they derail the negotiations completely?
That is the concern right now, that the momentum that was built in the past few days could completely fall apart if both sides cannot agree on what happens to these two corridors. I mean, Netanyahu says he wants a military presence in these two areas inside of Gaza for security reasons. But for a lot of Palestinians, this can be the start of a permanent occupation that could lead to the construction of new settlements. Some far-right Israeli politicians have said that in the past, this is exactly what Israel should do. In fact, here's what Eyal Holata, a former national security advisor for the Israeli government, said about this today.
There is, of course, a faction in the Israeli public, I will say it, that would the only way to prevent Hamas from regaining its control over Gaza is to stay in Gaza. But this is not just the Philadelphia corridor. This is continuous presence of the IDF throughout the Gaza Strip. This is reoccupying Gaza Strip and preventing Hamas from restoring its strongholds above ground and underground.
So, Caroline, these negotiations have been going on for months, and this is just yet another example of how complicated these negotiations are.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you for the update.
You're welcome, Caroline.
Reporting in the U.S. about China often gets tinged with animosity, whether the subject is the economy, control of the South China Sea, or Taiwan. China usually equals threat. We've taken a look at all these issues this summer with veteran journalist Jane Perlez, host of the podcast Face Off, the U.S. versus China. She joins us one last time this summer to tell an entirely different kind of story, a story about music. Jane, welcome back.
Thank you, Marco.
You spent years in Beijing as a New York Times bureau chief, and classical music was an important part of cultural life for you there. What did you notice?
One of my favorite things to do when I was living in China was going to concerts at one of the new modern concert halls. The one in Beijing is called The Egg. That's because it's a white egg-shaped building. I'd go to hear the Beijing Symphony Orchestra play a classical program on a Friday night, and the place would be jammed. There'd be parents with their small children, all dolled up. There were lots of young couples. It was clear the concert hall was a good place for a Friday night date. And what was really apparent, there was a great love of classical music.
When you say classical, was this mostly Western classical music or a mix of Western and Chinese classical music?
For the most part, it was mostly Western classical music, often with visiting orchestras from the United States and Europe. The Vienna Philharmonic came, the New York Philharmonic came, the Philadelphia Orchestra, which initiated the exchanges between China and the United States in the classical music field, would come. They first came in 1973, I believe, soon after Nixon and Kissinger did their diplomacy and opened up China to the United States.
Right, so that's a setup for where we're going next. And to make that move, let's enlist this archival tape of conductor Leonard Bernstein to help introduce what we're doing.
Now, here's a cultural image for you to ponder as you listen. A 7-year-old Chinese cellist playing old French music for his new American compatriots. Welcome, Yo-Yo Ma and Yu Cheng Ma.
Yeah, that's a clip I know really well. 7-year-old Yo-Yo Ma playing in concert before President John F. Kennedy. Yo-Yo Ma grew up from prodigy to now a world-renowned cellist, of course. And Jane, you spoke with him at length about the cultural threads that connect the U.S. and China. Why did you want to hear from him in particular?
I'm a super fan of Yo-Yo Ma. What else can I say? I was dying to interview him. In part because I love his story of coming to the U.S. as a 5-year-old child prodigy. He was born in Paris of Chinese parents who came to the U.S. because they wanted Yo-Yo to have the best musical education that the world had. And by the way, when Yo-Yo played for President Kennedy, it wasn't the president who impressed Yo-Yo Ma. It was Danny Kaye, the musician and comedian.
Right.
Yo-Yo told me he always remembers Danny Kaye being so friendly and jokey with the National Symphony Orchestra. And Yo-Yo said he thought to himself, even at 7, that's what I want to be like. He always says he believes in the power of music over politics. And I love that idea. It's very idealistic, very global, very anti-nationalistic. His idea of the power of music over politics should be heard just as much, if not more, than all the hard political grinding issues we face today.
Born in Paris to Chinese parents, raised in the U.S., and that experience, he told you, Jane, leaves Yo-Yo Ma to regularly question where he belongs.
You know, it's interesting, as someone who is of Chinese origin, but, you know, am I considered as one of them? Am I other? Am I Chinese as the pride of, you know, the Chinese linkage? I'm not sure I know where I fit in or where people want me to fit in. And of course, as a musician, that's simple. You know, you do music or whatever. And I never know because I'm always a visitor.
I mean, these are the classic identity questions of a third culture kid, but it's interesting to hear them being posed by someone who is so famous, whose talent and persona are so firmly fixed in our culture. Let's hear some of your conversation, Jane, with cellist Yo-Yo Ma.
I mean, I have so many strange stories of being in China, including going home, as in going to the place where my father was born, in Ningbo. In Zhejiang. And, you know, we trudged up half a mountain and we went to the gravesite of my ancestors.
What year did you go to Ningbo?
I maybe 90s. And then we had a big, you know, dinner party to meet all my relatives. And so many of them are teachers.
Just like your father?
Just like my father. What I found out from my relatives is, like, you know, I've always been part of sort of a educational kind of group of people, teachers. And I knew nothing about my family before that. I thought, you know, I knew a little bit about my grandfather, and that's it.
Your father didn't tell you when you were growing up in Paris?
I don't think he knew that much more.
What area of Paris do you know?
Well, we lived in the 5th arrondissement, the Latin Quarter. So right next to the Pont des Halles, which is, you could hear the bells ringing, you know, every quarter of an hour. It was bustling. I have actually great memories of that whole area. I was born in 1955 on the coldest winter, like, in 30 years. So much so that there was no heat in the little room my parents stayed in, so I had to stay my first month in a hotel. They remembered an American family in the same situation. Years later, maybe this is like in the 2000s, I'm playing a concert in Pittsburgh. And afterwards, some people came by and says, were you this kid that was in Paris during the coldest winter in 30 years and you stayed at this hotel? Well, because I am the other kid, the American kid that stayed in that same hotel. Weird.
Weird. Do you think things have gotten so, how can I say, fragile between China and the United States that we're almost in a Cold War, even with culture, because there's much less back and forth? Orchestras are not going as frequently. Artists are not going as frequently. Do you think it's getting to the point where actually artists will not be able to go so often, and that in future, when someone does go, it'll be seen as some huge breakthrough?
I don't feel we're at that stage now. When we hear there's clampdown or censorship or whatever, that I'm sure is absolutely real. That doesn't stop people from creating and thinking and, you know, I mean, it's like people are people.
So you're always the optimist, which is great.
I'm a huge pessimist, but I have to actually philosophically, in order to live, I have to be an optimist. I have grandchildren.
How old are they now?
6, 5, and 3. So, and I'm about to have another one. So a grandparent cannot see a grandchild and be pessimistic. You have to be positive. But I am scared to death about all the things that could go wrong and are going wrong and have gone wrong. I am so mad that people are so cruel to one another over and over and over again. These are choices that humans make, and we, you and me, I have to make that choice every single day in order not to be destructive, in order not to make things worse.
But part of the good news about China and the United States and China and the West, if I may say, is the great enthusiasm for classical music, as we describe it. I mean, what, tens of millions of Chinese kids are learning classical music, correct?
Yeah. You know, I think there was a mutual fascination. Classical music is highly developed. It was something in between sacred and secular music. It was in between court and folk music. It actually expressed a whole worldview as part of the Enlightenment. It expressed all of those ideals. There's a case to be made that, you know, the attraction was part of the whole
and
package.
And is, still is.
Of course, because we're still living as part of the Enlightenment.
Legendary cellist Yo-Yo Ma speaking with Jane Perlez there. This performance of Prayer by composer Ernest Bloch was recorded by Ma last year for an event called Music for Global Health and Peace, not unrelated to our conversation here. Jane, let me pivot from culture to politics now. As we look for ways to dial down the temperature in the U.S.-China relationship, and I'm guessing you've given some thought to this, how is Yo-Yo Ma the right ambassador for a message of optimism, as he puts it?
I think he's just tireless in carrying his message of enlightenment to all corners of the earth, not just the U.S. And I think it's good for Americans in particular to understand that at a time when China is vilified in the U.S., that there are historical and cultural currents in China and among the Chinese people who want their country to be a leader in the world, but not necessarily to be at war. Yo-Yo Ma is respected in both the US and China, and as he often says these days, he's a grandfather who'd like a peaceful world for his grandkids.
So all summer long, Jane, you shared your reporting with us on really difficult, even scary at times, topics in the U.S.-China relationship. Why was it important for you to take this little detour into the cultural threads that connect our countries?
At heart, I'm a realist. I believe, for better or worse, countries act in what they believe are their best interests. But at the same time, we can't all focus all the time on the doom and gloom. There has to be hope, a lot of hope. And I think Yo-Yo Ma and musicians and artists all over the world bring us that hope and some optimism, in part because they spend so much time perfecting their art. They use their art to broaden the human spirit. That's especially important at times like this.
That was Jane Perlez, the former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. She has been with us all summer to share her reporting from the podcast Face Off, the U.S. versus China. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thousands of people have had to evacuate Canadian communities this summer as wildfires have ravaged parts of the country. Officials say the fires have burned nearly 10 million acres this year. Now, some people say the way Canada responds to such disasters needs to change. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
When a wildfire breaks out in Canada, provincial authorities are the first people on the scene. If they need extra help, it's available, says Canada's National Defense Minister Bill Blair.
And we do everything that's possible to provide them with that assistance.
That federal assistance often comes in the form of the Canadian Armed Forces, which sends soldiers out to fight the fires. The Armed Forces spent a record 141 days last year supporting emergency operations. Retired Lieutenant General Andrew Leslie is among those who say that trend needs to stop. He spoke with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
I'm very proud of the work the Armed Forces does. I think we all are. And they respond at the drop of a hat, but it does eat into their available time. And it actually contributes to the exhaustion of the force.
Canada's House of Commons Defense Committee agrees that the armed forces can't be so heavily relied on. In a report this summer, the committee said the federal government should explore a permanent workforce to assist in responding to fires, floods, and other disasters. Because unlike many countries of its size and wealth, Canada doesn't have a federal disaster response agency. Advocates say creating one would provide much-needed relief to the provinces.
Down the road, yes, I do see a federal response capability.
Emergency Preparedness Minister Harjit Sajjan discussed the topic earlier this month at a press conference. He named the USA's Federal Emergency Management Agency, known as FEMA, as one source for ideas.
We have to take a look at what will our FEMA at the national level will look like. We need to take a look at not just what the U.S. is doing, it works well for them. But we're also talking to Australia, looking at their measures. And we've started even discussions with the French as well.
Minister Sajjan also said he's planning a trip to Germany to learn more about its program called the THW.
And that is Germany's Federal Agency for Technical Relief.
Eva Cohen is from Germany and now lives in Canada.
And it's quite unique in the world because it is 98% unpaid volunteer. So even though it's a government organization and a government agency, it really lives through the volunteers.
The THW has more than 80,000 volunteers across the country, and first responders call on them when disaster strikes. Cohen, who was a THW volunteer when she lived in Germany, says there are a few reasons why it works so well. To start, the government provides free training so anyone can participate.
You can picture anything from logistics to debris clearing to emergency infrastructure repair. There's basically no area that couldn't accommodate people's interests or skill sets.
There's also a budget to support volunteers when they're called to help.
If you have a position with the THW and you're needed, there's the wage reimbursement program where the government basically offers employers that they can get reimbursed if they have to hire someone else to do your job in the time you're gone.
Cohen says the volunteer element is also important as it fosters a strong community to lean on in hard times. She's lobbied for years to get a similar program in Canada.
You can see when a disaster happens how everybody wants to chip in, everybody comes to help. And Canadians like to help. And this is only a way that empowers people to do it correctly and know what to do and have the means and the tools and the training to do it.
Others in Canada warn against a federal disaster relief agency. Jack Lindsay, an associate professor of applied disaster and emergency studies at Brandon University in Manitoba, says the push for a national body is misguided.
We should really be looking at how the provinces meet their own needs and how they cooperate together to find that extra resource.
The country's federal government, he says, doesn't have the constitutional power to lead disaster relief efforts. Lindsay says federally organized volunteer programs could be a middle ground, but any plan needs to be tailored to Canada specifically.
We shouldn't be taking Formula One race car tires and sticking them on Canadian tractors, right? We need to be looking at what suits us best, rather than just looking for an overseas solution.
Emergency Preparedness Minister Harjeet Sajjan says his office would take the best lessons from the U.S. and other countries to form a plan that worked best for Canada. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Munich is famous for its beer halls and Oktoberfest, but lately it's having a sober moment. Join us tomorrow on The World when we'll look at the trend of alcohol-free beer. That's all the rage there. The buzz on buzz-free beer tomorrow on The World.
Finally today, we're ending things here on the show with a breakup song, Speed of Light. Despite the topic is musically pretty upbeat, the singer goes by the name of Dhruv.
Damn, you're wasting no time, he sings. Found yourself somebody new at the speed of light. Other tracks on his new album, Private Blizzard, include Grieving and Tragedy. Clearly, Dhruv has something on his mind. Now how I wish I could press fast forward to the day that I'm holding my brand new love. Dhruv's got roots in India. He was born in London, raised in Singapore. Moved to the States a few years ago to study at Yale, but then hit pause on college to get serious about music.
He'd been smitten with Bollywood by the age of 5 and would go on to write songs in private. One of them, Double Take, became a sleeper hit on TikTok 3 years ago. It went to number 1 in the Philippines and Thailand and hit the top 5 on the streaming charts in Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore.
This track, Speed of Light, is one of the singles on Private Blizzard. The debut album from Dhruv comes out later this week.
The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online at theworld.org, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you again tomorrow.